Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars,
the show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
Did you rehearse that?
I did, kind of.
I imagine you...
It was more like me in the car just being like, the podcast... It's like the podcast, no, the show, no, the nominee, no, the nomination. Like, I went through everything, so yeah. I'm kind of impressed with myself that I did it.
It was good, man.
Like, it wasn't me sitting here and be like, I got this. It was like, well, let's see.
Yeah. It was solid.
Thank you.
Way better than, like, the first three episodes I was talking about where I was like, take you.
No. See, I think everyone you've done is great. Going back and listening to the ones that I did, I'm always like, dummy. Dumb. Like, how did you miss this?
No, it shows evolution. Just like the evolution of the films that we talk about on this show.
Which is wild, because today is going to be a fun one to kind of talk about how production-wise and also just the movie itself doesn't really feel as much like an evolution as everything else. But it's also worth noting that this is the first movie of 1929 is when the movies took place, but the ceremony is 1930.
Correct.
Yes.
I got a little confused. I looked at the calendar and I was like, no, we already did.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's last year.
Like you said, next year that we do, so month of, I mean, wow, that's going to be...
I think it'll be March.
Yeah, March, yeah. Which, you know, we'll talk about that in a second. But the next year that we cover, it's going to be a lot easier. Yes. It's going to be a lot easier to know when these movies came out and when they when the ceremony was. Otherwise, it's kind of been kind of an umbrella of 27, 28, some 29.
And yes.
It's confusing.
Yeah, and this year was the wild one because the Academy was trying to catch up to their own mistake in a way and have the movies nominated fall into the correct window. So it was like November to, I don't even remember. I guess I should have looked at it. But they're starting to shift the window so that it is, hey, movies that came out in this year only.
Right.
Which is so nice.
A question for you, and you may not know the answer, so feel free to cut this out of the show.
Perfect.
Do we know that that stayed until current times, or were there any other like weird misses that they tried to catch up
with? I feel like I remember there being some issue that postponed the Oscars. I just read a book about it. It's either war or something with strikes.
Okay, that makes way more sense, actually,
yes.
That strikes would prevent that.
I don't remember 100%, but I feel like there was one of the two things that changed things. But also, there was a little bit of a shift during COVID.
Slightly.
Yeah, nothing crazy, but it did kind of shift the window a little bit for nominations.
That's correct. It did shift the window a little bit for nominations, and we'll get to that year in a couple of real-time years.
Yeah.
But a strange one, mostly because it didn't prevent them from having a ceremony.
Right.
It just prevented them from having certain nominations, and you can kind of tell.
Yeah. Prevented them from having an entertaining ceremony.
Correct. And an entertaining list of nominations.
Yeah.
Not bad, but certainly a little unlike the Academy.
Very limited.
Limited, for sure.
But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves.
By a couple, you know,
like
half centuries.
Yeah, 90 years almost.
Yeah.
Jeez. But yeah, let's talk about Disraeli from 1929.
Yeah, our first of the 1930 ceremonies.
This was directed by Alfred E. Green and starred none other than George Arliss as Benjamin Disraeli.
No way.
And then Doris Lloyd, David Torrance, and Joan Bennett. Big name.
Big name.
This was released by Warner Brothers. And tell us a little bit about Disraeli, Ryan.
Yeah, sure thing. So Disraeli takes... I'm trying not to read the entire plot synopsis here, but essentially George Arliss plays the Prime Minister, Disraeli.
Yep.
Yeah, he sure does. And essentially what we're watching is an excerpt of time in which he is interested in utilizing I'm trying to find the best way to say this. He's interested in purchasing the Suez Canal.
Yes.
And the inner politics of what it takes to have that happen. He's not the most popular figure, and this is seen as a very controversial thing. So there is a lot of politics behind him purchasing it, and this is essentially a 90-minute or so endeavor in how he purchases the Suez Canal.
He's sneaky. He's not super likable. He has some womanizing moments, I think. I don't like this movie.
It's not good. And I'm, you know what? It's so refreshing to walk into a podcast like this and kind of like, we've shared off pod. You're just like, I think your first thing you said to me was when we entered this room was like, I hate this movie.
Yeah. You said, good morning. I said, I'm upset.
Yeah. It's refreshing to kind of like start off just both being on the same page with this. I'll say that I didn't like absolutely hate it, right? But like, it's not great. And I shared with you the first half is just not that enjoyable. It's a lot of setup. It's a lot of like, hey, do you know this person? Do you know that person? You should. And it doesn't really get into the plot to a point where I was like, oh no.
Yep.
But then the second half is pretty, like, I can see where it's cooking. It's not cooking in terms of a good movie, but it's cooking in terms of like, wow, this would be a good play. And it is.
And it was.
It was. And we're getting ahead of ourselves just a little bit. So let's start at the beginning here. This is a movie that essentially is a camera placed in a certain position for a scene. Kyle described it to me when we first started talking about this movie pretty perfectly in the sense that it's a play and they found the best place to put a camera and said action.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah. And, I will say I watched a YouTube video. I forgot what it was actually about, but they talked about why early sound movies are awkward and why they exist the way they do. And there was a lot of talk about things that I forget. Cameras were really loud. So they would have to put what they called blimps around the cameras, these big boxes that kind of limited their mobility. I say kind of, extremely limited their mobility. So you went from scenes like the cafe in Wings, where the camera was going across on a dolly. You couldn't do that now because you had to provide a blimp around the camera to kind of cut out that whirring sound, since sound was an issue now. And then you get stagnant camera angles. And it makes for such a tough watch.
It does. And, you know, another thing about this movie specifically is I kind of noticed about halfway through that the angle looked a little strange.
Yes.
Not bad, but like a little weird to a point where if there's three people or there's two people on screen, but the person who's furthest left is almost cut off a little bit and you feel like there might be something to the left of them. So preservation wise, this movie has survived, but that in order for them to really make it optimal, they had to actually chop about, you know, maybe less than a third, obviously, but a significant part of the left part of the screen. So the movie doesn't look super out of place, but there are certain frames where it looks a little unintentional.
Yeah. Did you read like specifically why that is?
No.
This is not the only movie like this. There are a ton of movies from this era that had suffered the same fate. And what it is when the movie came out, it was sound on disc.
Mm-hmm.
So the soundtrack and the dialogue and everything was placed on basically a phonogram or gramophone or whatever they're called that would play simultaneously with the movie in order for it to get a wide release later, a re-release in like the early 30s. They changed it to sound on film, where on your actual film strip, what it is the left side of the film strip has the sound clip there. But in order to add that to the film, they had to cut some of the left side of the frame.
Interesting.
Because they couldn't, like, to fit on a whatever millimeter camera.
Right.
Forgive me for being a layman. You know, it had to still fit there, so you had to just overlap what was already existing on the left side of the frame.
Interesting. Was this something that spanned multiple years, or was it like 1929 was the year where they kind of ran into this?
I think it was any time they wanted to update a film that had been made film on disc.
Ah, oh, I understand.
That's what it was.
So it wasn't presented in theaters this way. This is the preservation of it.
Correct.
Understood.
Yes. So it's one of those things where had they not altered it to be film on sound, nope, sound on film.
There you go.
This would have looked, you would have gotten the full frame and it probably would have looked better, but the way that the sounds exist would be very different now.
Copy.
And it may not have survived because it wouldn't have gotten the same wide release that it did in the 30s. That probably, I don't know, reignited its popularity and made it worth preserving.
Hmm.
That's kind of an assumption, but it is one of those things where they're like, oh, let's re-release it. And that's the first step in preservation, I guess.
Interesting that we talk about preservation, especially the Lost Media episode with the Patriot. And this is one of the rare instances where we see that the preservation actually kind of hindered the presentation of it.
Yes. Yeah. And, you said a lot of it, it doesn't look bad. It just looks off.
Yeah.
And I think that overall that lended itself to just an unhappy feeling while watching the movie.
Sure.
Because it's little things where if there's a single person on screen, they're not centered up in frame.
Right.
And you're just like, whoever made this movie is kind of inept.
Yes.
As a filmmaker. And that's not true. It's just the way it feels.
Right. It's a tough feeling to beat too, because to your point, when we talk about, the way that things are shot, we kind of expect multiple angles. We expect some kind of like personality in the camera. And this is a movie where there's no personality in the camera. It's really just, where can I be to kind of capture this, I guess, performance? It's worth noting that there is a cast of characters here. You went down the list of actors who are actually in this movie, and they range from, present to like pretty good. They just aren't given too much here.
Right.
And in my opinion, we'll see what you think, and I have a feeling you're going to agree with me. In my opinion, this is George Arliss's movie. And I don't necessarily mean that in like, hey, this Disraeli guy is an unstoppable force. Wait until you see this. He's fine. And like the role itself is fine, but it really is just like, hey, everyone get out of the way. George Arliss is here.
Right.
For better or worse, I would say. When we talk about Disraeli himself, I will tell you that this is one of the most, that man doesn't look like that, roles for me. Where as soon as he appeared, I was like, I don't think that you look like that. Like, I can tell. It's one of the first instances in movie history for me where you can kind of see that, like, this man has a lot of prosthetics on. Whether it be the hairline or the nose, this man just does not look that way. A very tall head, by the way. I don't know if you caught on to that.
It is a very tall
head. A very tall head. He has a little bit of Sideshow Bob going on with his side piece on his hair. shout out to my Kelsey Grammer Simpsons fans. It's distracting. And yeah. It feels kind of like everything about this is him. And I want to go through a little history before we talk about like the plot of the movie and like, how things unfold. But specifically, this is based on a play. This play has existed for a while. Specifically, there are a couple iterations of this. So this is originally a Broadway play. In 1911, this existed as a Broadway play.
Is it Broadway or just a stage play in general?
Specifically Broadway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make sure because I don't know the history of Broadway. I don't know how, like, when that was a thing.
If only there was a movie that told us a little bit about melodies on such a place that we could have covered.
Maybe we'll watch it one day.
We'll have to. We're a couple 98 years away from doing that again. So 1911, it was a Broadway play specifically. Maybe it started somewhere else, but it was on Broadway in 1911.
Right.
And it was under the name Disraeli.
Yeah.
You're not going to believe that. So from then, it actually had a revival about 16 years later. So 1917, there was a revival, and you're not going to guess it. It was called Disraeli again.
Wow.
And then from then, they said, you know what? We got to do this thing again, but put it in the movies. In 1921, they made a silent film. What do you think it was called?
Hair.
Oh, you're so close. Because of his insane-looking Sideshow Bob
exactly,
hair.
Yeah.
No, it was Disraeli.
Oh.
So that was in 1921. And then they decided again in 1929, the year that we're covering now, that they're going to make another film now that it's a talkie. Right?
Yeah.
Hey, now we can get this performance fully fleshed out. It doesn't have to just be something you have to see in person or something that you can see in a silent film and just kind of infer the performance that I'm giving. Now you can hear the whole performance.
Yes.
And all of this just does feel very vain, right? In having like four iterations of this play that is put into like the second iteration on film, but all of it just feels very much like that. One thing pushes it beyond the point for me that it feels this way. And that's that in 1929, George Arliss also filmed The Green Goddess. Are you familiar with The Green Goddess?
Just the drink.
And also, of course, the dip in Sauce at the Melting Pot. I'm with you. I saw that in your face. I agree. Yeah, it's actually about the Sauce in the Melting Pot in 1920.
Wow.
It's not. So it was filmed and completed before Disraeli was, right? But it actually was held on to. So it wasn't released until 1930. So they held on to this movie. And the reason is, and this is not a joke, it was at the request of George Arliss because he felt that the film was a better vehicle for his talkie debut.
Disraeli was,
correct. Wow. So all of that to say that a lot of this and the movie itself just feels kind of like, hey guys, you should probably be looking at this right now. And it's George Arliss just going ham on this Disraeli role. So
this is George Arliss's GTA 6.
It is.
He's like, clear the calendar. You'll never believe what I've got cooking.
You guys are going to think that is like a month and a half old reference that Kyle is giving right now, but I need you to know it's extremely timely at the recording.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great bet. Did this feel, watching Disraeli, did it feel at all like a passion project and less of a movie?
Yeah, I mean, you can tell that George Arliss, not only is this his movie as far as his performance goes, but like, this is his movie.
Yeah.
He's running the show behind the scenes as well. And you bring up all of these iterations of Disraeli, you leave out the part where he has owned this role for all of those.
Oh, he is Disraeli in all those iterations, yeah. Correct.
So I think in 1911, when it first started as a stage play, I don't know if that was his, like he was the original Disraeli there,
mm-hmm.
but by 1917, he had performed 280 shows where he played Disraeli. And then he was in the silent film. He was in this film. He is Disraeli. This was like his legacy. It's not a great one, I don't think. I don't know. Like, how do you like political dramas in general?
I think the political dramas can be done very well. We're going to be talking in a couple of weeks, months, maybe, about House of Dynamite. I think that it's something that we still very much have in front of us at all times, right? I think it can be done very well. One of the best television series in my eyes that have come out in like the past 100 years or so is West Wing. You know, I think House of Cards, albeit from all of its demons, a pretty fantastic like written show. So I think political thrillers or political dramas can be done extremely well.
Yeah. I struggle a little bit with the genre in general.
Okay.
And things like House of Dynamite. I think you shift like political drama is one thing because you can kind of sort out the like, the grammar and the language to where you're like, oh, my eyes are kind of glazing over. We're talking about politics specifically. Yeah. And when you get to the thriller segment, you're just like, okay,
here we go.
Someone's about to launch a bomb.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. This is very much a political drama. It's a political biopic.
Sure. Yeah, no, it feels right.
And
I mean,
even that I struggle with. I try to think of like the most recent ones I've seen. Darkest Hour with Winston Churchill, but even that leans more into the thriller because you're talking about him during wartime, or usually these movies span the lifetime of a specific character, at least now. And this is kind of like, hey, here's, I don't know, a year of this guy's life, but very specifically like this one day where he fakes being sick so he can buy the Suez Canal. It's just, I struggle with this genre so much, and that's unfair to the movie, but also all of its shortcomings that we've kind of described, it being a very dry movie, dry performances outside George Arliss, like he is talented and he knows this role. It's just not one I'm interested in. And then you have the camera issues where it's, again, almost not the fault of the movie. It's a product of its time and the limitations of the camera because of sound. And then when you add the cutting off the left edge of the frame, this has so much working against it.
Yeah. This is where you would say but and say something redeeming.
Yeah. But yeah. There's really not a but for me. And that's sad.
Well, I think that there's a couple things that we can do. Like when we talk about the plot, I mentioned, you know, the overarching element is just this man is trying to buy. The prime minister is trying to purchase the Suez Canal.
Yes.
That's essentially the plot of it. But breaking it down, it does take place in 1874. Right. And the Khedive of Egypt has said specifically, I might be saying that wrong, that they are in dire need of money and that they are willing to sell the shares of the Suez Canal And Disraeli picks up on this and says, you know what? Totally. But everyone around him is letting him know, hey, man, what? You can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You shan't do that. And he's like, no, nah, I'm going to do it. And while this is happening, he has a couple people around him in his life. And this is where I'm going to tell you that contractually, we are obligated to let you know that there are other actors and characters in this movie. I don't know if George Arliss knows that, but there are. So specifically, the people around him, he has his wife. And this is what's interesting. In this iteration of Disraeli, the role of Lady Beaconsfield is, and that's Disraeli's wife, is played by George Arliss's wife. And she's also played that role in some of the other iterations of Disraeli. Sure. My understanding is that whenever George Arliss played this role, she did play the role of Lady Beaconsfield, I should say.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I think that lends a little further to like, hey man, this is my movie.
Yes.
This is my production. At the same time, he has some people around him, specifically Lord Deford Charles is someone who's in his life, and he sees as an aspiring politician that can be with him.
Oh, that's the young guy?
The young guy.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Don't like him.
Yep, not great. You also have, her name is, I'm blanking out now, the young woman who Charles is interested in.
Lady Clarissa?
Clarissa, that's it. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Charles is interested in Clarissa and actually sits down with her and says, hey, I think we should get married. And specifically, you could support me in all the endeavors that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And she says, get lost. Beat it. Not interested. I actually probably would have said yes, but the minute that you made it about you and not about me, I'm not as interested. And Charles sulks a little bit. And one of my favorite scenes in this movie is that they are having a very tender, quiet moment alone where Charles is proposing. Not even proposing. I don't know if you took it this way. He's proposing a proposal.
Right.
So he's like, hey, so hypothetically, if I did ask you to marry me,
yeah,
what would you say to that?
And it's very much like a, listen, this would be a good look for both of us.
he's playing it politically.
Right.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily what women want. I don't know if Charles knows this. And if anyone at home is wondering, not the smartest play.
No.
So maybe you just leave that out for right now. But hey, what do we know? So while this is happening and Charles is sitting down and talking with Clarissa, as soon as she says, hey, no, that's not going to happen, they kind of have a beat and they stop and they like kind of look to the right, almost as if like, hey, I think someone might be nearby.
Yeah.
And then the camera cuts and Disraeli is like maybe a foot away from them. Just like standing right, hovering over them, looking at them.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, oh, hey, Disraeli, what's up? And that's one of two scenes in this movie where they talk about like, hey, I think someone might be nearby listening to us right now. And then like someone's like breathing on their neck.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, no way. Where did you come from? And it just, it cracked me. I laughed so hard in this scene.
There are two things that are so funny about this. One, I imagine that Disraeli just crawled out from under the sound strip that they added onto the film.
Yep.
But two, in the like Letterboxd summary of this movie, they mentioned spies.
Yes.
I think that's what they're talking about. They're talking about little Disraeli just hiding in a bush going, ask her, Charles. Do it.
What a great proposal that was. Yeah.
It's so goofy.
It's very goofy, and I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
I laughed really hard at that. Also, maybe it's just the grain of the film, but there's a little part of you that kind of can't immediately see Disraeli, and not because he's hidden well. Like, he's just standing in front of the bush,
yeah,
and like whatever he's wearing kind of like, and it's not like he wore something specifically to hide in the bush.
He's
but like
camo.
He's not wearing camo or anything, but he's just kind of standing right against it, almost Homer Simpson style. Like, just right against the bush, mm-hmm. Hoping to be absorbed by it. And it's one of the funniest, like, still images that I've seen in a very long time. So kudos to George Arliss for that unintentional bit. But you mentioned spies, and there are spies in this, or at least they are identified as spies. Specifically, there are two individuals, and that would be Mrs. Travers and, who's the other guy? It's like it starts with an F. Full, there's like a J and a B in there. I don't know.
J.B. Fole.
Yeah, J.B. Fole, that's it. We forget his name because quite literally the only two scenes I can remember are him opening a door and being like, got it, and like closing it. And then opening a door and being like, oops, my bad, and closing it again. So there's another spy, and we are led to believe that they are Russian spies.
Yes.
Here to spy on the prime minister to see what he's up to so they can destroy the relations that they have. So my problem with this is twofold. I mentioned that there are characters in it, but it doesn't feel that way. And the reason it doesn't feel that way is that the way that George Arliss is playing Disraeli is that he doesn't have a single thought that isn't being said out loud, right? There's never a thought in him that's like, huh, I should play this close to the chest. Out loud at all times, he's kind of saying things. So it feels like it's less Charles and Clarissa's relationship, and it's more Disraeli wishing this to happen and putting things into place to where it does happen. But then instead of them thanking him or like, you know, cool, we'll do this, he's telling them what to do.
Right.
And especially the second half of this, you mentioned that he kind of like, this is where it's super play-y. It's very much just a production, or I should say a Broadway production, where it just takes place in his chambers.
Yes.
And I think the last 45 minutes, maybe more of this movie, is his chambers. And he's talking with multiple people. They just come in. And when they're supposed to come in, he tells them to come in. And when they're supposed to leave, he tells them to leave. And it feels like George Arliss is directing this movie. Like, specifically, Disraeli is directing this movie.
Yes.
And it's just so strange. Like, maybe that's why it was more interesting for me on the back end, because you almost literally see the character of Disraeli directing this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like, okay, cool, so what's going on here? But things will happen, and people come in and will be like, oh, man, I'm bankrupt, Disraeli. You won't believe it. And he's like, okay, I'll solve this. And then someone else is like, hey, I'm not going to give you that money. He's like, okay, I'll solve this. And it just feels so weird. It feels so weird. And the only thing I can think of, especially reading the production of all of this, is that it just feels a little bit like a vanity project.
Yes.
And you know what? You said it yourself, and spoiler alert, we'll be talking about this again. He gives a good performance. Like, you can tell, if not just from the way he looks, this isn't George Arliss.
Right.
Like, that's not just who he is. So he's acting well, but it feels a little, like, self-important, is the best way to put it.
Yeah. He's just showcasing his baby, really.
Sure.
And like you said, the second half, or second three quarters, whatever you want to call it.
It's not a long movie. It's like an hour and 27 minutes.
Right. Boy, it feels way longer than that, I tell you what.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like they added a little gimmicky, like, high school play twist to it.
Yeah.
That allows him to purchase the Suez Canal, where he literally invites people into his chambers and pretends he's sicky so he can be a little tricky. And it's just, I don't know, it's...
Well, and let's talk about that, because when he pretends to be sick, it's not even like, no one be around me. It's just like, oh, I just got the sniffles.
Yeah.
Like, I just need a little nap. I got a towel or a little blanket around me sitting by the fire. I'm laying down. Oh, I'm just not feeling my best. And at no point does anyone talk to him about like, oh, well, now we can take advantage of him. There's almost literally no point to him pretending to be sick outside of just not leaving his chamber.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I started to lose just what was going on with the plot. Because you really just, you get to the point where you don't care. You don't care.
Yeah.
And I hate that. I want to sit down and I want to engage with these movies, and that's my whole thing. But he's laying there on his little couch with his blankie. What's going on? He buys the Suez Canal. Cool. Yeah.
Well, this whole movie is just like, could have been an email. The whole movie could have been an email.
It could have been.
Because what ends up happening is he ends up sending Charles... I should back up just a little bit. When Clarissa turns down Charles' proposal, again, Disraeli says, little Dizzy, take a stab at it. And he says, well, hold on. I think he has promise. I see promise in him. So if I bring him on in a role in my cabinet and give him some purpose in life, would you take him back? And she's like, yeah, probably. So he does that. And he puts Charles in this position. And specifically when he has to send Charles after half of the Russian spies, not Mrs. Travers, the other Mr. Fishbowl, whatever his name is, leaves, they say, well, he's on his way to Russia to report in everything he's found here that you're going to buy the Suez Canal. So Disraeli says, well, I'm going to send Charles. And they don't know that we know what they're onto. So I'm going to send Charles into Egypt specifically to finalize this trade. And he's going to cash this check given to me by Mr. not Travers. It's the banker. Myers. Hugh Myers, I believe. I'm getting this.
No, I'm, yeah. Anything you say to me at this point, I'll be like, yeah.
Yeah, I believe you. That. So it is Myers. So Hugh Myers runs the bank and says, hey, yeah, sure. You have the money, whatever. So all that happens. And then Hugh Myers shows up. He's like, hey, man, I'm bankrupt. Like something has happened. You're never going to believe it. Maybe a Russian spy is involved. I don't know. Maybe her name is Mrs. Travers. I don't know. And they're the reason that I don't have the money. Disraeli is like, it's Mrs. Travers. I know that she did this to you. Not a problem. Let me figure it out. And then he leaves. And then he brings in Mr. Probert. He brings in Mrs. Travers. Mrs. Travers shows up. He's pretending to be sick. I'm ill. Please have pity on me. But by the way, are you a Russian spy? Did you happen to maybe cause this bank to lose all of its money? And she's like, yeah, 100%. I bankrupt him. I'm the reason there's no money. I'm the Russian spy, totally. Just all this is given up for some reason because Disraeli is so good at pretending to be sick, I guess.
Yes.
He's like, cool, got it. Brings in Probert. And Probert is essentially the only person who can reverse all of this and give credit to the bank. And he has said this whole time, hey, man, there's no way that I'm going to fund your little endeavor to buy the Suez Canal. And essentially, Disraeli says, hey, actually, not sick anymore. Now I'm powerful again. If you don't sign this bill that gives unlimited credit to the bank, then I'm going to sign it myself and make it happen. So it's happening one way or another. I'd love for you to get the credit on this, though. He's like, fine. If you were going to do it anyways, I guess I'll do it, but I'm not happy about it. He signs it and leaves. And someone's like, wow, I didn't know you had the power to do that. And Disraeli's like, I don't. He doesn't know that, though. And you're like, oh, that tricky Disraeli. And now Mrs. Travers gets to see him be like, all right, cool. Now you have the unlimited credit for the bank to spend the money that you want to buy the Suez Canal. So you're good and you have owned the Suez Canal. Great. Movie is essentially over, right? No.
Yeah. Oh.
Because it cuts now to, hey, cool, I bought the Suez Canal. I want to thank everybody. He's going to, I think it's the wedding of Clarissa and Charles.
Okay.
Or maybe it's just church. They're going into a church. That's all I know. Right. So he comes out and his wife is sick, right? Lady Beaconsfield is sick. And he's very concerned. The doctor's like, I don't know, man.
Things aren't looking good. This is more than just throw a blanket over.
Exactly. Like, he is essentially like, I'm not joking. I've made this voice a couple times, but he is essentially like, I don't know, Disraeli. It's not looking good. So Disraeli comes downstairs and he is like, hey, I just kind of want to, almost like a curtain call. It's like, I want to thank the people who got me to this position, specifically Hugh Myers. And Hugh Myers walks up. He's like, yeah, you can go away. And now I want to thank Mr. Probert. And Probert comes out. He's like, yeah, you can go away. And it just feels like Disraeli more, again, directing everything happening than like bringing people in and working with them.
Yes.
And he does the same thing for Charles. And then as he is thanking Charles, he gets a letter and he opens this letter and he's like heartbroken. He's like torn to pieces about reading this letter. And his wife just walks up. He's like, hey, what are you reading? He's like, oh, I thought you were dead. She's like, I'm not. And the movie's over. And it's never explained what he read. And the whole thing just feels very like nothing happened. This could have been an email.
Listen, I am so glad that you summarized all of this movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember 90% of that. I remember at the end, he opened the letter and he was sad. And then my eyes glazed over.
Yeah.
And I thought his wife was dead. You just changed the entire ending of the movie for me. I still don't like it.
There's a very real possibility that this is Seventh Heaven. And she did die. And he's just like, hey, look who's here, everybody. And everyone's like, what's he doing?
Wow. Let me stop bashing the movie. And let me just say,
he is not at gunpoint, I want to point out.
Help me, Ryan. Say something else positive.
I mean, I enjoyed the last part of this. Like, it's a bit like mania. Like, it's a manic thing. Mm-hmm. And I see why he was nominated for Best Picture. For Best Actor in this.
Really? He was kind of nominated for Best Picture.
Best Picture, George Arliss. Yes. He's like, I did it. He was nominated for Best Picture. Let's just say that. I see why. Because he is indeed giving a performance. And it just feels very much like a self-important, self-grandizing, like, it had to be me kind of thing. I'm trying to think of who the modern-day version of this is. But
Bradley Cooper.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Bradley Cooper and Maestro. Where you're like, yeah, okay, I see what we're doing here. What's interesting to me, though, is that at least Bradley Cooper had the foresight to direct himself in this. And this isn't directed by George Arliss, right?
No, it's not.
So it just kind of feels like George Arliss is just sort of commandeering everything rather than like owning the production.
Which is so interesting. I really imagine what it was like on set while Alfred E. Green directed.
Mm-hmm.
If it was one of those moments where they're filming a scene, they say cut, and then George Arliss is like, listen, Alfred, good chap, take it again from the top. Like, this isn't how I did it 281 times previously. Let's hit it again.
Yeah, like, probably.
I don't know. We didn't talk about what this was nominated for.
We didn't. The only other thing I want to mention that we hadn't before is you talked about the sound on disc technology, you know, sound on film, and how that removes the leftmost of the screen. Another part of it, too, is that there are actually 3 minutes cut off of this movie.
Right.
So what we're seeing is a shorter version, granted, all of, you know, 3 minutes. Maybe those 3 minutes were him being a little sick boy in, you know, by the fire with his little blankie. But there are 3 minutes that are lost in this specifically. So it's described that it's pre-code footage. I don't know what that means because there really isn't anything too controversial in this in terms of what the code wouldn't allow. Maybe the political sense of like the actions of political officials, but the only thing that I've seen is the description of the minutes that were cut out labeled as pre-code footage.
I wonder if it actually has anything to do with content and just when it got re-released.
Or it's more just historically it was pre-code because the movie is pre-code.
Right. As are all of the films we've been talking about up to this point, which will really take a big play next episode.
Yep.
Stay tuned for that. But yeah, I don't know. I really think it might just be, oh, we lost 3 minutes and this is pre-code. But there's no connection between the two.
I think so. You know who's torn up about those 3 minutes being missing, though?
Georgie boy.
Dang it!
You lost 3 minutes.
My best work.
Now I'll have to remake this in 1937.
It is worth noting that I don't believe anywhere that I see this listed that it was remade after this, correct? So this was, by my research, the final iteration of Disraeli.
I think there was some BBC special or something like way later.
Was George Arliss involved?
Probably.
You'd have to be.
Yeah.
He is Disraeli.
The only one.
It's very interesting because the majority of the movie he is kind of depicted. Everyone's just kind of like, God, this guy's just crazy. This guy's bonkers. But like in the movie, he's just like, okay, I just think I want to buy the Suez Canal. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Just let me buy it. Why can't I do that as prime minister? And he's trying to help people around him, but like it's never clear exactly why he would want the Suez. It's weird.
Yeah, it's all a political gain and how to gain favor with the queen and this, that, and the other thing. You know the scene in The Godfather when Vito Corleone is playing with like his grandson, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And he has the orange slices in his mouth and he's goofing off.
Yeah.
That's Disraeli to me. He's like the Godfather, but only when he does the silly things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I think that he thinks that he's doing a lot of Vito Corleone.
Yes.
Like stuff, but in reality, he's just got orange slices in his mouth.
Exactly.
I also think of that scene in Wolf of Wall Street when Jordan Belfort, Leo DiCaprio, is like dancing very goofy. I think that's a similar thing to Disraeli, where everyone's just like, Disraeli, and he's probably like getting goofy with it on the dance floor, but he's not really doing a lot of like commandeering when it comes to, he's doing some little like trickster moves with spies, I guess, to like trick them into giving him enough money to buy the Suez Canal, right. I suppose.
But he's also hiding in bushes and like pretending to be sick.
Yeah.
It's just a little silly for me. And did this spark any kind of interest towards this real life figure for you?
Oh no.
Yeah.
I mean, on the downside that like it is almost a comedy in the way that it's played, and I don't think it's intentional.
No.
But it's also, I mentioned the two spies. There's the two spy moments. The first one is the one that actually just destroyed me of Disraeli just standing in front of a bush next to them. But then later on, Disraeli's having a conversation with Charles, again very privately on a bench. And they kind of like look to the corner, like maybe someone's behind us. And like Mrs. Travers is just standing like very clearly right next to them on the other side of a bush. And they clock her almost immediately. Like as soon as Disraeli turns his head, he's like, oh, Mrs. Travers, hello, didn't see you there. And that to me, again, just like, I think it isn't supposed to be funny. I think it's just the way, how do we film this where people can see it on camera. Because on a production stage, like a Broadway stage, we can probably have it to where like the audience sees them, but like these characters don't.
Right.
But it wasn't really thought out very well with this. So it feels very comedic to a point, to answer your question, where any interest that I had in this real life thing, I was like, well, clearly he wasn't this goofy, silly little guy. So I think this is just more an interpretation that I'm okay leaving alone.
There is a part of me that wants to see like a boring, very accurate historical, I don't know, 30-minute special just to know if he really was, like, did he buy the Suez Canal because he pretended to be sick?
Yeah.
That's really all I want. And then I can lay this to rest with all 282 George Arliss performances.
Crazy. Well, hold on. Are you counting the 1917 film he did? Or 1921, I'm so sorry.
No, darn it.
282. There you go.
But let's get back to what it was nominated for.
Yes.
It's important to note that, of course, this was nominated for Outstanding Picture. But not only was George Arliss nominated for Best Actor, he did take home the win for this. Surprise, surprise. Surely he was campaigning for this, right?
Oh, I think he was campaigning for this while filming the movie.
Right? Like, he showed up at everybody's house and was like, come for tea, and I'm feeling ill.
This is the last time I'll play Disraeli. And he has the blanket on by the fire.
Yeah. I wonder if there was, well, this is probably ceremony talk, but I'll throw it out anyway. I wonder if there was any of that, listen, he's done this for a long time. Like Glenn Close has been nominated like 8 times already or whatever.
Right.
She's due for an award. I wonder if there was any of that associated with this from the Academy where they said, I know it wasn't a movie, the 280 times, but this man has put his whole life into this one role.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a similar situation to where, like, if they end up making a Hamilton movie and Lin-Manuel Miranda reprises the role of Hamilton on the big screen production of it, if he wins an Oscar, it's the same thing where it's, well, you've done so many performances of this and you've dedicated your whole life.
Right.
It's actually a very funny thing to compare this to Disraeli, because that's another, you know, not to say it's a self-aggrandizing performance, but that's one where he kind of built the whole performance or the musical around that performance and that character.
Sure.
And has, in a very similar way, honestly, maybe that should be my double feature rather than what I'm going to say, but it would be a similar situation where you're like, well, does that count? Because you've had so many performances to do this, and we've seen you perfect it, and now it's just we're putting a camera in front of it. So, to me, I feel like there's a lot of firsts that George ends up getting with that. We'll get into it with the ceremonies, but to me, it feels like kind of like it has to be this kind of situation. Right. So I don't know. I'm sure there's some campaigning there because of all the firsts that would make it. Granted, it's only the third, but there's a lot of implications of Disraeli. It's technically a remake, right? Mm-hmm. He is a British actor. Like, there's a lot of firsts in this.
Right.
So to me, that feels kind of like it has to be this way. So he's going to campaign for it.
Yeah. Yeah. In addition, this was nominated for 3 things. We mentioned the first 2, the third being Best Writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for Julian Josephson. That's always one of those interesting things for me, having not seen the stage play, having not ever will see the stage play. Is this just straight up pulling dialogue from that play and just laying it over film?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, is Julian Josephson the original writer of the stage drama?
That's where I think things are interesting now in the way that we split, mm-hmm. right? Adapted versus original.
Right.
This didn't exist back then. So now it's kind of the conversation of, would it be original or would it be adapted? We're in the controversy of Barbie. Barbie is based off a property and not a specific, you know, script. So is it really adapted in that sense?
Right.
There's a lot of talk about that. I think personally this is adapted, since there's been, to your point, 280 plus performances of this play.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's just an adapted screenplay, even if you changed a few things.
Looking at Julian Josephson, he was just a film... a screenwriter.
So he took the took the script of the Broadway play and wrote a screenplay around it.
Correct. But again, you know, who's to say how much he just took straight from the play?
If George Arliss was in it, then you know it was a lot of the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Wow, that's the other thing. If it's the same exact thing from the play, did George just hop on set one day and go, yeah, I know the lines, roll it?
Yeah.
Let's go.
That's why, honestly, I think that's the case, because the way that it seems on screen is that the other character, I don't want to say characters, the other actors are kind of just like directed by him.
Yeah.
Where he's like, well, why don't you, and he's physically pushing, go out of the room.
Yeah.
And why don't you come in? And it just feels weird.
It is a moment that I think is kind of rare in movies where one actor is so skilled, and in this case knows the role so well,
mm-hmm.
that the rest of the movie is brought down by that performance.
Sure.
And you can almost see the other actors be like, line. And George is like, I got you. Here we go.
You can almost feel like little moments of like that exact scenario where there's a little bit of silence.
Yeah.
And he's like, that must upset you, doesn't it? And Charles is like, very much so. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if George would have been down to do a one-man show of this.
I think he did.
Fair play.
I push in the same way that I tried to say that a Hollywood Review, maybe unfairly, isn't really technically a movie.
Mm.
Still a lot of fun. It's just technically not a movie. I think this is technically a one-man play. There happens to be other people like also on set at the same time, but I think that George Arliss is kind of steamrolling them and mostly like doing their dialogue for them to where they just have to say, yes,
I agree.
No, I agree.
I'm broke.
Yeah. I'm broke. That's my favorite performance outside of Disraeli is Myers, because Myers just has to be like, hey man, I don't know how to tell you this. I'm broke. Yeah. Just like holding his head in his hands. It's great.
It's pretty good.
A very big fan of it. So ultimately it was those three, right? It was best actor, outstanding picture production, however you want to label that.
Yes.
And screenplay. Those were the three nominations. Am I correct in that?
That's correct. Yeah.
Nailed it. Let me ask you this. I could say the Muppet thing, right? Like, if you had to like make a Muppet movie and replace one actor with all of them, who would it be? And I think very clearly the role here is you keep George Arliss as Disraeli, but then you put everyone else as Muppets.
Yeah.
I don't think that's fun, because that's essentially what this movie is anyways. So yeah. I want to like kind of push you a little bit on this. I want you to do this exercise, but Disraeli can't be human.
Okay.
Disraeli has to be a Muppet. What human character would you leave, and which Muppet would play Disraeli?
Myers, I would leave.
Yeah. I'm broke. It's Myers. That's true. The banker.
And Disraeli would be a Muppet. I would make Disraeli Rizzo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
He's just sneaking up in the bush, and he's like, what do you mean you won't marry him?
I see promise in him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Rizzo's a really good call. I was honestly thinking Fozzie would be a really good Disraeli.
Nice.
Just because I'm thinking of Fozzie wig in Muppet's Christmas Carol.
My goodness. Fozzie laying on the couch with a blanket over him like, oh, I'm not doing so good, guys.
Just the actual human hand like brushing up against his face, being like, yeah, oh, I'm so sick.
And they're like, look, I'm dripping with sweat. And he takes his little flower and he like sprays himself in the face. He's like,
well, especially when he like tricks people, he can do the whole waka waka thing.
Yeah.
And there's just like, yeah, I think Fozzie would be a great pick in that.
Solid. I like it.
God, that's so funny. So did you have any trouble thinking about a double feature for this?
The hardest time.
Really?
Yes.
I feel like of the two that we're talking about, and we'll, the next episode, everyone will be spoiled on that. This is the one that I had the easiest time.
Wow.
Like once I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm in.
I have the stupidest double feature.
Well, mine would be smart, but it was very quick. I'll say that. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first because audience, you are going to be disappointed.
Oh?
I was like, let me think of a political drama.
It can't be
drama.
Another George Arliss Disraeli production.
No.
I should say that.
I wouldn't put anybody through that. I was like, I'm going to think of a political drama. I thought about like The Darkest Hour.
Sure.
I did think about Maestro because I saw the similarities of Bradley Cooper and the kind of self-praise of performances and things like that. And then I went very, very immature, I guess.
Okay.
I took one look at Disraeli's head and his hair, and I said...
You did not do Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius.
Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius.
Did you legitimately?
I did. And it's not even just because of his hairstyle and all of that.
Oh my God.
I think that you need a break after you watch Disraeli. And I think you should go watch just some goofy, you know, mid-2000s cartoon and just have some fun.
Oh, man.
It's not a good double feature. I get that.
I disagree.
I don't know. This was a tough watch for me. Go watch Jimmy Neutron. What's your double feature?
Oh, my God. I'm losing my mind. The dip of Jimmy's hair and then the anti-dip on his forehead. Yes. With Disraeli. Yeah.
If you were to headbutt these two characters, it would create some kind of just balance in the universe. Their hair would interlock together. And I don't know. I think we'd be in a better place somehow.
I mean, what's so funny is like, I see the vision. Yes. Like, you didn't just pick a children's film. Like, I see the vision of the self-importance of Disraeli and then the ego of Jimmy Neutron.
Yeah.
But put towards science instead of politics.
Jimmy Neutron, self-professed boy genius.
Self-professed. Yeah, exactly. And Disraeli, self-professed
Suez Canal buyer. The only one, baby.
I think that if Jimmy had the money and wasn't so busy with fifth grade, he would have bought the Suez Canal.
100%.
Yeah, or at least stolen it.
Yeah, with his little laser ray.
Yeah, so yeah. Mine's not nearly... I should have gone first. Mine's not nearly as inspired as that.
Sure, that's what we can call it.
Yeah, I would, certainly. No, I think that Disraeli is very much... The movie Disraeli is very much a performance of one man among many people. And there are people in the room, but essentially the movie is this person.
Right.
And it made me think of Kenneth Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express.
Oh.
It feels very much, hey, everyone gather around and let me tell you what's happening in this movie.
That's solid.
And granted, it's a little bit more, I think that is kind of the role with Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah.
And he isn't talking over other people, but everyone's just kind of wondering where he is all the time. Whenever it's just Johnny Depp and someone else speaking, just Daisy Ridley, everyone's like, yeah, hey, that's cool. Where's Kenneth Branagh in that mustache right now?
Yes.
Where is Mr. Perot to help out in this, Detective Perot? That is exactly where my brain went. Almost to like the way that that George Arliss is playing Disraeli, the way he like talks about certain things. He's less of a politician and more of a detective, especially with the way he hides or lack thereof, and the way that he expertly is a master of disguise. You know, puts a blanket on, stands by a fire. I'm dying. So it's... I think those are two insane double features.
Dude.
Jimmy Neutron and Murder on the Orient Express.
God.
I almost would have gone a little earlier with like 1978 Death on the Nile or like the original Murder on the Orient Express. But there's something about Kenneth Branagh's performance as Perot that feels a little more hammy.
Right. And like you said, he directed that movie.
He did.
So there is that. Solid.
Thank you.
I am always very impressed with your double features.
I try my best.
And
Don't hold me to that with the next one.
Listen, man. At this point, I've double featured a Muppet amusement park show. I've done Jimmy Neutron. I've got to do some.
I think you're winning. For what it's worth, by my count, you're winning. You know what? Everyone, when you're reviewing the episode and you're telling us what you think about it, let us know who's winning the double feature war right now.
Yeah.
I personally think it's Kyle because he's going to use Jimmy Neutron and Muppet Vision 3D as a downscale, and that's an upscale to me.
Hey, I'm going to say one more interesting fact about Disraeli so I can feel better about my Jimmy Neutron pick. Vanity Fair. We don't talk a lot about like the history of film review and like entertainment news and things like that.
Right.
Vanity Fair, though, started in like the late 1800s. You know how they're kind of known for their caricatures of celebrities and things?
Their lie detector test interviews. Totally.
Yeah. Wow. That just happened, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, their caricatures... The very first caricature Vanity Fair ever did was Disraeli.
George Arliss as Disraeli?
No.
Oh.
It was just Disraeli.
Okay.
So I thought that was interesting because I had never heard of Disraeli as an actual figure, person. So it was interesting to see just how far his celebrity reached. And it was, you know, popping into entertainment news through Vanity Fair in the form of a caricature and kind of started a whole industry. In a way. Or a whole, what would you say, gimmick?
Yeah. Gimmick sounds right.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting that this is 56 years removed from, this movie is 56 years removed from the events it takes place in, right?
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of, well, how at the time prevalent was this figure?
Yeah.
Was it more prevalent to where this made more sense, where the depiction was almost a caricature of that? Like, there's a lot of aspects that you and I don't know.
Yes.
So there's that interest as well, with Vanity Fair having a caricature of the real-life figure of Disraeli. That paints some additional, you know, questions about the status of this.
In the United Kingdom, were people learning about Disraeli in schools? And is this a bigger deal than I think it is, or... does the movie play it in such a lighthearted manner that I'm like, yeah, they bought the Suez Canal? I don't know. I'd be curious, but not enough to actually go and do the research.
No, I mean, I think that the way that George Arliss plays him is less of a historical excerpt in time and more of an interpretation.
Yeah. It doesn't leave you with a sense of pride.
It doesn't.
In a way that I feel like such a big purchase and historical event for the United Kingdom was... he's a goof.
He's a goof.
That's it.
That's the best way to put it. We talk about praise a little bit. It was obviously received very well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for being nominated for the three awards that you talked about previously, there's other reviews that have come out saying that it set the standard, right? It raises a set standard. Praising Arliss as, you know, is the whole picture something that we've said, maybe not as great as a light as other reviews have meant it. But there's a lot of, you know, great reviews, compelling portrait of a character that Arliss is portraying, criticizing its sound and set design a little bit there. So it was received mostly pretty well. And I don't know if it just hasn't aged extremely well.
Sure.
But for you and I, for this being beyond the 10th movie that we reviewed here, it's a bad beat.
Yes. This is my least favorite experience so far on the show.
I would agree.
As far as watching a movie goes. This, when we started the podcast together, having already covered this on the first run of the show, this was one of maybe five movies that I covered in the span of 2 years that I was dreading. So I'm glad that we've got it behind us now.
I was looking forward to today's episode because of this, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. What I can say about this, we've talked about the first of genres many times. This is the first, like, not even political biopic that we cover, but the first biopic in general.
Yeah.
I don't know why it took me so long to say that. I felt like I was one of the other characters in Disraeli who needed my line fed to me by George Arliss. But yeah, this is the first time we're covering a movie like this, and these are kind of controversial movies at the Oscars even today. So
it's also worth noting that in, you know, almost 100 years of nominations, awards, ceremonies, some of these movies just aren't going to be it. And like a lot of it is subjective. Yeah. I mean, art is subjective. Like it's going to come down to it. So they're not all going to be incredible. There's going to be some that are better than others. Honestly, I think that you take the good with the bad. That's sure. The biggest thing. I've talked about that on the podcast plenty of times. And I found the humor in it a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it's supposed to be a comedy. Based on his performance winning Best Actor. Sure. I assume this was not a comedy, but it was very funny to see that. And I think we kind of have to embrace that a little bit because it's not taking anything away from anyone. I think George Arliss does very much put on a very large performance. It's not what I would say the best, but, you know, we haven't gotten to our other productions yet or other nominations. So who's to say?
Right. This is just the first of this year.
Yeah.
So let's talk ratings.
Yeah. Man, I don't know.
Listen, I gave it a 1.5.
Oh, okay.
That's my lowest to date on the podcast. I've made it very clear why I feel that way, so we'll just move right to your rating.
I would say my rating would probably be, I wish I could do a 1.75.
Sure.
Because that feels, you know, 1.5. No longer a girl, not yet a woman, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Not a 1.5, not yet a 2.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite feel like... 2 says I like it too much, and 1.5 says it's too bad. Not quite there.
Okay.
So I'd like to say 1.75, but just to kind of balance things out, I'll say 1.5. Yeah, that sounds right.
Perfect.
Because I can't necessarily recommend it.
No.
But I did have a very fun time with the last half of it, just kind of laughing with it. I think it's an incredible movie to drink to.
Okay.
If you have like 2, like gin and tonics, Disraeli's going to be a blast.
Yeah. Every time he's a sneaky boy, take a sip.
Well, I'm not going to do that to anybody.
Yeah.
But he's... Well, hold on. How many times he thinks he's being a sneaky boy you're absolutely blackout drunk by the end of this.
Right.
The amount of times that he is a sneaky boy, you may have sniffed.
Yeah, you tasted a little bit of something.
A little bit.
Sure. That's really it. That's all.
That's all, folks.
So next week, yes, next week we'll be covering The Love Parade, directed by Ernest Lubitsch. Stay tuned for that. I have thoughts.
We actually, I don't know if you want to break the news here, this is the first year where we're going to have a guest.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Confirmed.
Absolutely. So that'll be for our All Quiet on the Western Front episode, which will be, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks out. I should have looked at the calendar. But regardless, it's coming later and it's exciting.
It'll be out in December.
Yeah. I've got to have the calendar when I sit down and do this. I was like, December. But
time is menial to us now.
This is true.
Fabric of reality.
If you would like to send in your thoughts on George Arliss, not his performance, just George Arliss in general, because that's what this movie is, let's be real. Reach out to us at outaopodcast@gmail.com. I have made the Once Upon a Time at the Oscars letterbox. That will be in the show notes. Give us a follow there. That will have the complete list of movies in the order we're covering them on the show, as well as our combined reviews of the movies and like our double feature things. That's a work in progress, but follow us now. And social media, check us out on patreon.com/outaopodcast. Anything else you want to add before we wrap it up?
If we got it wrong, if you think, hey, you know what? Disraeli is actually fantastic and you guys are really stepping on George Arliss's production here, let us know. Send us a little email. Send us, you know, some comments or something. Let us know. I don't think we are.
I won't read him.
I actually, in real time, just logged my rating of Disraeli on Letterboxd.
Nice.
And I'm going to go ahead and say, I don't think that we're going to get a lot of little discussion against the truth here.
Probably not.
I think people won't disagree with us for the most part. This is a movie that I don't think has any 4 point or 5 stars, mostly around 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Which is fair.
I think that's a good hunch.
Yeah, I'd say so too. But like Kyle mentioned, send us letters. Let us know. Ask us questions. In real time, maybe around the ceremony episode, we're going to share those and read those out loud. If you have any questions for us, we're going to answer those. Or if you just had very nice things to say, we're going to say, aw, thanks.
Exactly. That's all I've got. In the words of the great Jimmy Neutron, got a blast.
In the words of the great Disraeli, I'm just not feeling my best right now.
Oh, that's my favorite line. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm broke.
And we'll
see you at the movies.